Okay.
Anybody need sheets? You need, I'll get sheets. Okay.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Brand. It's great to be here at the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Kollel of Chicago. And great thanks to Aaron and Rivka Friedman for sponsoring the Kollel Midrash Yom Rishon. I'm a prime bookworm. I'm a beginner's rabbi. I've been a beginner's rabbi since 1975. I'm hoping one day to become a real rabbi, but it doesn't look too promising. I'd also want to thank the Mara D'Astra, Rabbi Engel. We go back, actually even before Fairfield. We did a bris together in Tenafly.
Yeah, Tenafly.
Was it Tenafly, right? Okay, so it's great to be here. And I wish the entire community much hatzlacha. There are a lot of my friends here, my former students, and just want to acknowledge my driver from the airport, Ira Harris, and my drivers to the airport will be the Kantoroviches. So thank you very, very much for taking care of me. Now, if you take a look at the source material, which I will refer to intermittently, you'll see the very famous introduction to the Mesillas Yesharim. If you want to look at the actual wording, you could look inside. But basically, the Mesillas Yesharim is going to say, has said exactly what I'm going to say. I'm not saying anything new today. Everything that you've heard of, that you will hear today, has been said before by others and probably even better than I. But it's important to reiterate these issues. Now, interspersed between halacha and agadata, I'm just going to start with a midrash. Contemporary midrash. There is such a thing as contemporary midrash. When Adam, by the way, is Adam, was placed in the Garden of Eden by God, he was amazed at everything. The smell of the flowers made him dance. The sound of the birds made him sing for joy. But of all the things that amazed Adam, the most amazing to him was the sun. It warmed his face without touching him, and it was the only thing in the garden that he could not reach. When the wonderful sun disappeared behind the edge of the garden, Adam was really afraid. He cried all night long, and he kept his eye on the exact spot where the sun had disappeared. After a long while, he felt something warm on his back. He turned around, and he saw the sun peeking over the other edge of the garden. Adam was happy but confused. Then God explained to him how the time from one going down of the sun to another going down of the sun was one day. The time of 7 days, 1 week, and the time of 4 weeks, 1 month, and the time of 12 months, 1 year. Then God stopped telling Adam about time. Adam began to think, God has told me that this day will be followed by 6 other days to make 1 week, that this week will be followed by 3 others to make 1 month, and that this month will be followed by 11 others to make 1 year. But what time will come after 1 year? Maybe no time. Maybe the sun will go down and never come up again. Adam was still amazed at things, but now he was frightened and worried. He counted the days and the weeks and the months, waiting for 1 year. He counted and waited and worried. By the time the 12th month came around, Adam was fidgety and nervous and could not sleep at night. A year is the biggest time. When the year is used up, all time will be used up. The sun will go down and never come up again. I'll have to live in the cold and dark. We'll not be able to see the flowers or hear the birds, and we'll trip over everything. On the evening of the last day of the last week of the last month of the year, Adam could not sleep a wink. He went around the garden, chewing his fingernails and saying goodbye to all the things in the garden. To each living thing, Adam said, I guess I won't be seeing you tomorrow. If I've hurt your feelings this year, I'm sorry. I hope you'll forgive me. Then Adam would kiss the thing and move on around the garden. After a while, just after having finished saying he was sorry to some bug, he felt something warm on his back. He whirled around and saw the sun peeping up over the edge of the garden again, just like every other day of the year. Then Adam heard God, the Ribbono Shel Olam, counting. 10 years are 1 decade. 10 decades are 1 century. 10 centuries, 1 millennium, etc., etc. By this time, Adam had fallen asleep. He was amazed at the bigness of time. Time was even bigger than the sun. Adam decided to remember the end of each year by apologizing to all living things he might have hurt during that year. He felt better doing it, and he remembered how scared he had been during the first year. When Adam awakened the next day, he smelled the flowers and heard the birds singing. In Judaism, we have a concept of propitious times. Sha'os ha-kosher. Sha'ot ha-kosher? What do they use here? Ashkenaz or Sephardi? Depends who I am. Okay. Sha'ot ha-kosher. Propitious times. We know that we have propitious times for good. Shnichnas Adar Marvim B'Simcha. We know that there are propitious times for bad. Mishnichnas Av. That the time of Av is not supposed to be a very good time. You shouldn't go into any big business deals in the month of Av. You shouldn't go to the Beis HaMishpat to try to avoid litigation. Nisan is the month of Geula, propitious time for Geula. My father, Olav Shalom, used to tell about the propitious time that Jews have. Well, you know we have propitious times when you light Shabbos candles, and you have propitious times at a bris. You can pray for a refuah shleima. You have a propitious time for under a chuppah, chasen kala. My father used to speak about the propitious time of Shavuos, that exactly at Jewish midnight, chatzos, the himmel spaltzach, the heavens open up, and you can ask for a few seconds whatever you want for. And the Nebuch, this poor guy, has been waiting a whole year to ask, and exactly as Chatzos comes, exactly at midnight, he's so nervous that he starts stammering and stuttering, and he prays out to HaKadosh Baruch, he says, Ribbono Shel Olam, send me down a yarmulke with golden coins. By the time he got the words golden coins out, the heavens had closed, so all that came down was a yarmulke. But the point is that there are propitious times in the Jewish calendar. There are special, special times for propitious time for Jews. And this is exactly what the months of Elul and Tishrei are. It's the propitious time for tshuva. Why is it a propitious time? As you see in your source material, the Navi Yeshaya says, Dirshu Hashem bihimatzo, karau biyoso karov. Call out to God, search for God when He is there, when you can find Him. And call out to Him when He's close, when He's nigh. What does that mean, when God is nigh, when God is close? You see, we have a very special relationship with God. God wants us. He desires us. He chalishes for us. He thirsts for us. He really, really desperately wants us. And He comes out to us. God is in the fields. God comes out. You'll see the mashal that Rav Shneur Zalman of Ladi, that God goes out like a king who comes out to the field so all His people can see Him, can be with Him. He's there waiting for us to return. Why? Because the Navi Yechezkel says, Ki lo achpots b'mos hametz. God doesn't want us to die. Ki im b'shuvo, that the Russia should return from his evil. Midarko, from his evil road, the Chaya, so that he should live. We are glad on Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is a happy time for us. It's strange. The whole world is judged, and it's a happy time for us. Why? Because we have confidence in the judger. We have confidence in the judge, that the judge is going to find us. Somehow he's going to find a way by doing all sorts of somersaults, by doing all sorts of calisthenics, to find us guiltless. Somehow he's going to work out a system that we can come out cleansed and clean. That's because our Father in heaven really wants us to return. You know, the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Bracha says, Makom shebalei tshuva omdin ein tzadikim gemurim yicholim lamo. In the place where a Baal Tshuva stands, even the most righteous cannot stand. In the place where a penitent stands, even the most righteous. So of course the cynics say, why can't a righteous person stand in the Makom Shebalei Tshuva? Because she stinkt von Chaza. It smells from Chaza. That's why, because, you know, everything that they had before. But that's not the way the Gemara, of course, explains it. that when a person who has been challenged and repents from that evil way or from that wrong way or from the way that he just didn't know, the tzaddikim didn't have that challenge. There's an incredible mashal which I believe is absolutely true. The mashal basically says that every human being is tethered to God with an umbilical cord. Not when you're born, but there's a spiritual umbilical cord that every single human being has. And when you sin grievously, that umbilical cord, that tether, is cut, is severed. And we're detached from God. But when a person does tshuva, that cord is reattached. It's tied together again, and we're reconnected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So listen to the nimshal. The nimshal is that once you've sinned, your umbilical cord is shorter because there's a knot in it. You're closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Makom shebalei tshuva omdim, ein tzadikim gemurim, ichol lamu. That's why Chazal valued tshuva so profoundly. Because tshuva brings you, perhaps, we don't know, brings you perhaps closer to the Ribono Shel Olam than we ever were before. Who can imagine that we could be closer? We're closer to that HaKadosh Baruch Hu than we ever were before. Now, how does that HaKadosh Baruch Hu judge? How does that HaKadosh Baruch Hu judge? You take a look at the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva. The Rambam, and I'm skipping through the source material because I know my time is short. But the Rambam basically says the mashal of the scale. Very profound, but to a sense, in a sense, simplistic. That you have your mitzvahs, you have your masim tovim that are put on one side of the scale. The other side of the scale are your chovos, your misdeeds, your mistakes. And then on the end, you're balanced. But it's not only the balance of an individual, it's the balance of the whole world that's on the scale. Because your balance may tip the balance of all humanity. So it's a tremendous, tremendous, incredible responsibility. But how does God judge? How does God judge our mitzvahs and our zdonos? How does he judge? And this, the Rambam also says, it's not in your source material in Parak Beis. The Rambam says that there are certain mitzvahs that are small, some are large, we don't really know. But it could be one little mitzvah might tip the whole scale. And again, I invoke the memory of my father, Alav Shalom, who told this very unusual story. He told the story that there was in Poland a farmer who was a virulent anti-Semite. He used to taunt Jews at every opportunity that he possibly could. One Friday afternoon, there was a coach, a wagon that was going from one town to the other, filled with Jews. And there had been a raid the night before, and the wagon got stuck in the mud on his land, near his land, on the road near his land. And the Jews got out of the wagon, and they started pushing the wagon. The more they pushed the wagon, the deeper it got caught in the blunder, in the mud, in the muck. They started beating the horses. Nothing helped. And this farmer is standing on the side, never did anything good in his life, and he's taunting the Jews, and he's laughing at them as they're pushing harder and harder. The wagon wheels are getting caught deeper and deeper in the mud. And finally, he like screams out, "Dirty Jews, get away!" And he takes a whip and he chases them all away. And he unhitches the horses. And he hitches himself to the wagon. And with one great heave-ho, he pulls the wagon out of the mud. And the Jews get home to their village in time for Shabbos. Well, when this farmer passed away, of course, the heavenly angels were waiting for him to lead him right through the fiery furnaces, of course. And they were all dancing, you know, ready for him because he had never done anything good in his life. At the last minute, he's about to be thrown into the fire. A little angel comes and he says, wait, don't you remember? He saved a wagon load of Jews.
who were going from one village to the other. So the other angel says, what are you talking about? The guy never did anything in his life. He says, I insist on a tribunal. And they bring the tribunal, they bring the scales, and they take all his masim raim, all his evil deeds, and they put this one mitzvah on the other side, and of course it's completely overweighed by his evil deeds. So they grab him by the shoulders and they're ready to throw him into the fires again. And the angel says, just a second. You can't just judge him that way. Think of all the mitzvahs that he caused these Jews to fulfill. They heard Machal Shabbos, they were able to light candles, they made kiddush, they had a motzi, everything. I insist that you put all their mitzvahs on the scale. Put the mitzvahs on the scale. Again, his averus weighed it all the way down. Again, they're leading him to perdition. And the angel says, just a second. I think it's important that the instrument of the mitzvah be put on the scale. I insist that the wagon be put on the scale. They bring the wagon, they put it on the scale. It's still a one. I insist that the horses be put on the scale. They bring the horses, they put the horses on the scale. And finally, the little angel gives up hope. And they're ready to throw him into oblivion. And he says, wait, there's one more thing. The blood, the muck, the mud, the mud. They bring the mud, and the mud, at least according to this tale, outweighs everything. What is this story? It's a very strange story. But the truth of the matter is, I think that's trying to communicate that we don't know what our deeds, the value of our deeds. We don't know how the Kaddish Baruch Hu, how the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to judge us. It's a conundrum to us. We don't know. It may be that the blatta, that the shmutz that we gather, can actually turn into our defenders, can turn into our mitzvahs. And this is what the Gemara says in Yuma. The Gemara says, Gedola tshuva, this is source number 5, Gedola tshuva shezdonos nasos lo kishgagos. That what? Tshuva can turn our zdonos, are purposely defiant types of misdeeds into shgagos, into coincidental, accidental misdeeds. And not only that, v'al hashav me'ava, says the Gemara, that if a person really turns with love, out of love, amrush d'donos nasa lo kishuyos, that the actual misdeeds can be turned into merits. We don't know how HaKadosh Baruch Hu judges us. That if you really are contrite, if you really are sincere about your tshuva, and you do it with honesty and with ahava, then those donos can turn into merits. Unbelievably. They can be our zechuyos. The Gemara and the Rambam says in source 6 that each and every one of us needs to see ourselves as Beinonim. We have to see ourselves as Beinonim, as not too evil and not too good. And during Aseres Yemei Tshuva, we have the opportunity to repent, to prove to God that we are really tzaddikim, that we are really righteous. You know, very strange things happen on Rosh Hashanah evening. On Rosh Hashanah, we say, Shana Tova, Tikatevu, Techatemu, Altal Chayim, Mosholam. But you can't say that after the first night of Rosh Hashanah. Why? Because we're supposed to look upon ourselves as Beinonim, as people who are not all righteous and all evil. But you're not allowed to look at your friend as a Beinonim. You're supposed to regard all of your friends as tzaddikim. And the tzaddikim, the righteous people, are immediately judged, l'alto l'chaim, are immediately judged to life. So by saying someone, l'shara tova tikategu, on the morning of Rosh Hashanah, not Friday night, but Shabbos morning this year, you're insulting him. It means you're saying you weren't a tzaddik. So you're not allowed to say that. So you say in a gemara, chasiva tova, whatever you say, okay? Have a good year, have a good life. Whatever you say, but you can't say. You should be inscribed and be written for a good year, because if you are really a tzaddik, you are written for the good year, the night before. So we need to see ourselves as Beinonim. God judges us qualitatively, not quantitatively. And that's how we are truly judged. Now, there are various steps of tshuva. The Rambam itemizes certain steps of tshuva. Other Rishonim itemize different steps of tshuva. But basically, the most important step, probably, is hakaras hachet, to recognize that we've done something wrong. Hakaras hachet, to recognize that we've done something wrong. Azivas hachet, separating ourselves from the sin. Charata, to feel bad about it. Kabbalah lahaba, a resolution that we should never do it again. And then the Rambam also brings down vidui, that it's important for us to articulate it. It's important for us to say something. You see, one of the mistakes of contemporary human beings, and I would say even a lot of Jews, is that we don't understand that it's important for us to concretize what we do. People take it for granted. I feel like a good Jew in my heart. I feel like a frum Jew in my heart. I feel good about myself. The truth of the matter is that feeling like a good Jew in your heart is important, but it's not a determinant. I have to tell you probably one of the most embarrassing stories in my career. This took place about 30 years ago at Lincoln Square Synagogue. I'm embarrassed to tell it, but I tell it all over. That's Hakaras Hachet. I was teaching a class introduction to the Bible, which I still teach at Lincoln Square. And a young girl came in. She was about 16 or 17 years old. She was a very sensitive soul. I could see that she was a sensitive soul, sort of like a delicate neshama. And she came in with her non-Jewish boyfriend, whose name was Shorty. I guess he was short. And I had spoken to the parents, to her parents. They were very upset that she was going out with this non-Jew. And they finally prevailed on her to come with him to the class, hoping that it would break him up. In any case, Shorty loved my class. As soon as I began speaking, within 5 minutes, he was out cold snoring. He used to wake up at the end of the class. He says, "Rabbi, I feel great." I thought I would like to package my class, you know, into bottles and sell it for insomniacs, you know. And they even signed up for the second term. And after that, I lost contact with her. I tried to call, etc., etc. 2 years later, she was probably 18 or 19 years old. I get an invitation to a wedding. And the wedding is going to be at 770 Eastern Parkway. And the name of the chassan is a Jewish name. I couldn't believe it. So I wasn't going to miss this one for anything. So I go out to 770 Eastern Parkway, which of course is the headquarters of Chabad. And I see the girl there. She's sitting in Brooklyn Jewish Center. That's where they have the bedeckin. And there's a big room filled with people, very crowded. And she's sitting up front, and she was very beautiful. She was such a delicate soul, you could see her. And I was just so happy to see her, I couldn't believe it. There were tears down my eyes. They're leading the chassan into the room from the chassan's tish. And it takes a very long time for the chassan to reach the kala. And I couldn't see from where I was standing. And then I see how the chassan is struggling to veil the kala. The chassan had cerebral palsy. And it broke my heart to see how he struggled to put the deck tichel on. And you know they use a very thick tichel, the Lubavitchers. So you can't see anything once you're covered. I'm standing there, the room is packed, and there are some like ladies standing behind me, secular ladies. And they're looking at this scene, and they're saying out loud, one is talking very loudly, arrogantly. She says, "Look what they're doing to that poor girl. This is barbaric. This is primitive. This is medieval. I can't stand this. I'm so wound up." And I couldn't take it. She kept going on and on and on. And finally, I turned around to her, and I said, I guess the most hostile word that I could say publicly at that point. And I growled at her and I said, "Lady, rah, you know, lady. Had this ceremony been taking place on the Himalayas with a guru presiding, you probably would have said, how intriguing, how interesting. I wonder what it means. But because it's Jewish, you have nothing but disdain for it. So she was like taken aback, you know. And she said to me something that was true about 30 years ago. She looked at me and she said, young man, young man, I'll have you know that I feel like a very good Jew in my heart. Now you get the reference, okay, where I'm going? Not yet, huh? I should have kept quiet. I know I should have kept quiet. But I'm from the Bronx. The Bronx is a borough of New York, you know. People are very outspoken, arrogant, stuff like that. And I looked at her and I said, lady, feeling like a good Jew in your heart doesn't make you any more a good Jew than feeling like an astronaut in your heart puts you on the moon. Now, I don't know what divine inspiration I got at that moment. You know. Well, anyway, she slapped me. No, she didn't. But, and I regretted saying it the minute it came out. After the chuppah, there was a receiving line, you know, where the Kallis family, the Hussis family was standing, and you walked through the receiving line, and they were so happy to see me, Rabbi Buchwald, Rabbi Buchwald, I'd like to introduce you to the bride's aunt. And I said, we've met her. And I apologized. Now, the truth of the matter is, that feeling like a Jew in your heart is very, very important, but it's not enough. It's just not enough. That's what mitzvos masios are all about. That's what the rituals of Judaism are all about. You can't just say, I feel the Sabbath coming into my abode. When you light those candles, suddenly you concretize the candle, the Shabbos coming into my home. I can't just say, I sanctify all of food. But when you lift the challahs up and you make a bracha over them, you feel that food is sanctified. Or when you make a bracha of Birkas HaMazon, you realize how important food is and what a gift it is. Or when you bind yourself with tefillin, you're connected to God. That's what articulation, that's what the vidui is all about. Saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that I've done wrong. You know, we live in an era, I think Carl Menninger, the famous doctor, psychologist, psychiatrist, wrote a book in the 1970s, Whatever Became of Sin? We no longer talk about sin. Whatever became of sin? You can't do, there's no such thing as sin. You can't say that someone is doing wrong. Even these people who talk about valuing, you know, you go to Harvard, you talk about teaching children values. Well, you don't teach children right and wrong. You just say, how do you make the decision? Whatever your decision is okay with me. I'm from the Bronx. So I grew up listening to contemporary music. There was a movie, I think, called You Light Up My Life. And Debbie Boone sang a song, You Light Up My Life. And there was a lyric in that song that said, how could it be bad if it feels so right? How could it be bad if it feels so right? That's where we are today. That if it feels good, it automatically becomes right. I want to go further. I know that Rabbi Kahn is from South Africa. And according to my tradition, this story that I'm telling you now took place in Johannesburg. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But it's a very interesting story. You know that in the British Empire, most of the synagogues are traditional. Most of the synagogues are Orthodox. Most, you know, 70%, 80% of Jews in England who go to shul, go to Orthodox shuls. And then they have what's called liberal. Liberal is probably the equivalent of conservative in America today. And the same thing in South Africa is a very traditional community.
like 60-70% of the kids go to day school, right? There in Johannesburg, at least when I was there. And there's a liberal movement, but the liberal movement is very small. So the Orthodox don't really have much to do with the liberal. They don't even want to recognize it. But on one occasion, an Orthodox synagogue and a liberal synagogue decided that they were going to have a forum on the similarities and differences between us. And this was unheard of in Johannesburg. So there was a big commotion about it, and a lot of people came out. And the Orthodox rabbi gets up, and he begins to speak, and he says, he quotes the Gemara that says, Yehudi afilu alfa pi shechata Yehudiyu. A Jew who's sinful, it makes no difference, you're sinful, you're still a Jew, right? Cardinal Listica became a cardinal, an archbishop, Listica, in Paris, right? According to our tradition, he still has to keep Shabbos and kosher and everything else, okay? We won't give him a mafiona on Yom Kippur, but he's still considered a Jew. We won't count him to the minyan. He won't get the privileges of a Jew, but he has all the obligations of a Jew. Yehudi afopi shechata Yehudiyu. Even though a person is sinful, he's still a Jew. He made a spiel and he sat down. The rabbi of the Reform Temple got up and he looked around the audience and he saw the president of his liberal synagogue. And he said, Joe, would you mind standing? I want to ask you a few questions publicly. And Joe stands up and he says, listen, Joe, do you keep kosher? He says, kosher? Of course, no, we don't keep kosher at hypnosis. We don't have to worry about that. Everything is cured now. Nothing to worry about. What about the Sabbath? He says, I go to the temple on Friday night, you know. He says, do you drive? I says, of course I drive. What's wrong with driving? And he sat down. And then he looks in the audience and he sees the president of the Orthodox Shul. Now, remember, a lot of these people are not practicing Orthodox, but they all go to the Orthodox synagogue. So Sam, he says, Sam, would you stand up? Sam turns red like a beet. He starts to sweat. He starts shaking in his seat. And his friends are pushing him up. Hey, come on, Sam, stand up. We know the answers, you know. Stand up. Don't be afraid. He's so mortified. He stands up. And he's like half a minute. And the rabbi says to him, Sam, you're the president of the Orthodox synagogue? He says, yes, I am. He says, do you keep kosher? Everybody's gawking at him. He says, well, in our house we have separate dishes, but when on the road, you know, it's not always easy, I can't. And he's like ready to collapse. He says, what about Shabbos? He says, Shabbos, I try to keep Shabbos. We try to go to the synagogue. Do you drive on the Sabbath? He says, well, we usually try to walk, but in inclement weather we drive, but I never park in the parking lot, always 2 blocks away. And he falls into his seat, mortified and embarrassed. And the rabbi held up his hands triumphantly. He says, you see, Orthodox, liberal, reform, they're all the same. It doesn't make a difference. And the place went wild. Now, there's a difference of opinion of who the rabbi was in the audience. It could have been Rabbi Hanman from Panovich, or it might have been another rabbi who was visiting from Eretz Yisrael. And he asked for the right to speak. And he gets to the microphone, and he turns to the Orthodox rabbi. He says, Rabbi, you were wonderful. He says, Reform Rabbi, you were brilliant. He says, but I have to point out one profound difference between the answers that these two gentlemen gave. They both gave the same answers. He says, but there was a profound difference. You asked Joe, the president of the Reform Temple, whether he kept kosher. But Shabbos, he says, you asked the same question to Sam, you got the same answers. But Sam turned red like a beet. He was mortified, he was embarrassed, he was ashamed. And that's what the prophet Isaiah, that's what the prophet Yeshaya says in your sources here. Source number 8, important. Yeshaya, in the first parak of Yeshaya says, Im yuchata eichem kashanim, Kasheleg Yalbinu. If your sins will be as red as crimson, they can become as white as snow. Im yadimu katola katzemer yiyu. They can become as white as wool. What does that mean? What does that pasuk mean? That pasuk means that if you feel contrition, if you're embarrassed for your deeds, it doesn't make a difference whether your actions are different from another person. But if you feel contrite, if you have hakaras achet, if you recognize that you're doing something wrong, then we can change. But if you don't feel that you're doing anything wrong, if it feels so good that it can't be wrong, then there's no way that you can change. Judaism is often ridiculed because they say it's filled with guilt. It's filled with guilt. It's a guilt-ridden religion. Brian Buchwald, Orthodox rabbi. Judaism is a guilt-ridden religion. You're right. But there's a difference between what's known as constructive guilt and destructive guilt. Destructive guilt is no good. Destructive guilt is says, I'm going to die, I'm going to be punished, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to bring a bolt of lightning down on me. I can't live with myself. Constructive guilt is when you say to yourself, I'm doing the wrong thing. I recognize I'm doing the wrong thing. I'm going to try to be better. I don't know if I'm going to succeed in becoming better, but I'm going to try to be better. That's what Aseres Yemei Teshuvah is about. If we acknowledge that we're doing something wrong, Hakaras Achet, and we make a little move. That's the Rebbe. He was once asked, you know, how far is north from south? And he said, Ein klein drei. It's just one little turn. When I'm turning this way, I'm facing north. All of a sudden, I'm facing south. But if you make one little turn in your life, you can suddenly be from Mizrach to Maariv, from Durham to Tzafon, from east to west to north to south. That's what we're talking about. Recognize it. Im yuchatayichem kashanem kashchelei yalbinu. If your sins will be as red as crimson, that's constructive guilt. You know, the Kutzker Rebbe was once asked, and this is a profound, profound message for all of life. The Kutzker Rebbe was once asked, who's higher on the ladder? The person on top or the person on bottom? He knew it was a setup, and he answered back very profoundly. He said, it depends which direction they're going. If the person on top is on his or her way down, and the person on the bottom is on his or her way up, then theoretically the person on the bottom is higher than the person on top. If you ask me, Brian Buchwald, Orthodox rabbi, someone would call me an Orthodox rabbi, not everybody. Who's higher? What's a good Jew? What's a good Jew? Would I say Orthodox? I would not say Orthodox. I wouldn't say Reform. I wouldn't say conservative. I wouldn't say Zionist. I wouldn't say secular. If you ask me to define what a good Jew is, I would say a good Jew is a Jew in the growth mode, M-O-D-E. Anyone who's trying to be better than he was yesterday is a good Jew. That a Jew who's wrapped up in talis and tefillin on the top of the ladder, and he's glad, kushan, cheats in business, he's on his way down. And another Jew is breaking his teeth to learn alephes, he's on his way up. Who's better? And that's so profound. Now what about Yom Kippur? Where does Yom Kippur come? Where does it fit in to all of this? Our attempts at tshuva, our attempts at hakaras, Achet, our attempts at vidui, where does Yom Kippur fit in? Because Yom Kippur, it seems to be very, very strange. What does the Shulchan Aruch say? We don't eat, we don't drink, we don't wear leather, we don't engage in sex, we don't anoint our bodies in oil. All these inuyim that we take upon ourselves. What's the story behind it? All right, we're trying to do tshuva, so we afflict ourselves, we afflict our souls. But I think that it's even more profound. And here I'm going to bring a source, which I didn't bring down in the source materials, really out of left field, completely out of left field. I don't think that you'd expect a rabbi, maybe not even someone from the Bronx, to cite this source. But I believe that one of the most profound sources for as preparation for Yom Kippur, and I'm a little reluctant to do this here, but I think that it's so valuable that I'm going to take my chances and I'm going to do it anyway. And the source is a poem that was written by a non-Jewish woman. Her name was Edna St. Vincent Millay. Even the name is not so very Jewish. She was born in 1892 and died in 1950. This poem was published in 1917 when she was 25 years old. And she won the Pulitzer Prize for this poem. And the poem is called Renaissance or Renaissance, which of course means renewal. Now, I could give you a summary, but I think that it is so profound and that it's so appropriate for Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah that I'm going to try to share it with you, see whether I'm a good poetry reader. Now, the whole idea is that Edna St. Vincent Millay, who was a young woman at this age, at 25 years old, she writes this poem about how overwhelmed she is by life, overwhelmed she is by the world, that all she sees in the world is death and destruction and sorrow and poverty and hunger and tragedy. And that is the way her poem begins. The very famous lines is, "All I could see from where I stood was three long mountains and a wood. I turned and looked another way and saw three islands in a bay." So this was a whole world. That was it. You know, these three long mountains and a wood. "So with my eyes I traced the line of the horizon, straight thin and fine, straight around till I was come back to where I started from. And all I saw from where I stood was three long mountains and a wood. Over these things I could not see, these were the things that bounded me. And I could touch them with my hand, almost, I thought, from where I stand. And all at once, things seemed so small, my breath came short and scarce at all. But sure, the sky is big, I said, miles and miles above my head. So here upon my back I'll lie and look my fill into the sky. And I looked, and after all, the sky was not so very tall. The sky, I said, must somewhere stop, and sure enough, I see the top. The sky, I thought, is not so grand. I most could touch it with my hand, and reaching up my hand to try, I screamed to feel it touch the sky." So her world was so circumscribed. It was so limited. It was so small. It was crushing her that she could literally reach her hand up to the heavens and touch it. And listen to her agony. "I screamed, and lo, infinity came down and settled over me, forced back my scream into my chest, bent back my arm upon my breast, and pressing of the undefined, the definition of my mind, held before my eyes a glass through which my shrinking sight did pass, until it seemed I must behold immensity made manifold." She had this like nevuah, she could see the whole world. "Whispered to me a word whose sound deafened the air from worlds around, and brought unmuffled to my ears the gossiping of friendly spheres, the creaking of the tented sky, the ticking of eternity." And what did she see? "I saw and heard and knew at last the how and why of all things past and present and forevermore. The universe cleft to the core lay open to my probing sense, that sickening I would fain pluck thence but could not, nay, but needs must suck at the great wound and could not pluck my lips away till I had drawn all venom out. Oh, fearful pawn for my omniscience, I paid toll in infinite remorse of soul. All sin was of my sinning, all atoning mine, and mine the goal of all regret. Mine was the weight of every brooded wrong, the hate that stood behind each envious thrust, mine every greed, mine every lust. And all the while, for every grief, each suffering, I craved relief with individual desire. Craved all in vain." A little poetic, but now it gets real. "And felt the fierce fire about 1,000 people crawl, perished with each, then mourned for all. A man was starving in Capri. He moved his eyes and looked at me. I felt his gaze. I heard his moan and knew his hunger as my own. I saw at sea a great fog bank between two ships that struck and sank. 1,000 screams the heavens smote, and every scream tore through my throat. No hurt I did not feel, no death that was not mine. Mine each last breath, that crying met an answering cry from the compassion that was I. All suffering mine, and mine its rod, mine pity like the pity of God." So this is the overwhelming feeling of suffering and pain. And what is there in life? What is there to live for? Wherever she turns, she sees misery. Awful weight, infinity pressed down upon the finite me, my anguish spirit like a bird beating against my lips I heard, yet lay the weight so close about, there was no room for it without, and so beneath the weight lay I and suffered death, but could not die. What kind of life is this? Long had I lain thus craving death, when quietly the earth beneath gave way, and inch by inch so great at last had grown the crushing weight, into the earth I sank, till I, full 6 feet underground, did lie, and sank no more. There is no weight can follow here, however great. From off my breast I felt it roll, and as it went, my tortured soul burst forth and fled in such a gust that all about me swirled the dust. She's now dead, in a grave, relieved from the pain. From the suffering. Deep in the earth I rested now. Cool is its hand upon the brow, and soft its breast beneath the head of one who is so gladly dead. One line. And all at once and over all the pitting rain began to fall. I lay and heard each pattering hoof upon my lowly thatched roof, and seemed to love the sound far more than ever I had done before, for rain. It hath a friendly sound to one who's 6 feet underground. And scarce the friendly voice or face, a grave is such a quiet place. The rain, I said, is kind to come and speak to me in my new home. I would I were alive again to kiss the fingers of the rain, to drink into my eyes the shine of every slanting silver line, to catch the fresh and fragrant breeze from drenched and dripping apple trees. For soon the shower will be done, and then the broad face of the sun will laugh above the rain-soaked earth, until the world with answering mirth shakes joyously with each round drop, rolls twinkling from its grass-blade top. How can I bear it buried here while overhead the sky grows clear and blue again after the storm? O multicolored, multiform, beloved beauty over me that I shall never, never see again. Spring silver, autumn gold that I shall never more behold. Sleeping your myriad magics through, close sepultured away from you. O God, I cried, give me new birth and put me back upon the earth. Upset each cloud's gigantic gourd and let the heavy rain downpour in one big torrent, set me free, washing my grave away from me. So here she's lying, Nebuch, in this grave. She's dead. And suddenly the rain comes. And suddenly she sees that she's never going to see the beauty of the rain, of a raindrop falling on a grave grass, on a blade of grass. And she prays that she should be given life again. Give her a second chance. I ceased, and through the breathless hush that answered me, the far-off rush of herald wings came whispering like music down the vibrant spring of my ascending prayer. And crash, before the wild wind's whistling lash, the startled storm clouds reared on high and plunged in terror down the sky. And the big rain in one black wave fell from the sky and struck my grave. I know not how such things could be. I only know there came to me a fragrance such as never clings to aught save happy living things. A sound as of some joyous elf singing sweet songs to praise himself, and through and over everything a sense of glad awakening. The grass, a tiptoe at my ear, whispering to me I could hear. I felt the rain's cool fingertips brush tenderly across my lips, lay gently on my sealed sight. And all at once the heavy night fell from my eyes, and I could see a drenched and dripping apple tree. A last long line of silver rain, a sky grown clear and blue again, and as I looked, a quickening gust of wind blew up to me and thrust into my face a miracle of orchard breath, and with the smell, I know not how such things can be, I breathed my soul back in. Got a second chance. And this is how she concludes. Up then from the ground sprang I and hailed the earth with such a cry as is not heard save from a man who has been dead and lives again. Only a person who's dead and comes back to life
constrained with such doing. About the trees, my arms I wound, started hugging trees. Can you imagine a human being going to a tree and hugging trees? Like one god man, I hugged the ground. I raised my quivering arms on high. I laughed and laughed into the sky, till at my throat a strangling sob caught fiercely, and a great heart throb sent instant tears into my eyes. Listen to what she says. Oh God, Ribbono Shel Olam, says Edna St. Vincent Millay. Oh God, I cried, no dark disguise can ever have to hide from me thy radiant identity. I will always see HaKadosh Baruch Hu, now that I know what I was missing when I couldn't have it. Thou canst not move across the grass, but my quick eyes will see thee pass. Nor speak, however silently, but my hushed voice will answer thee. I know the path that tells the way through the cool eve of every day. God, I can push the grass apart and lay my finger on thy heart. In other words, God, you could try to tiptoe past me. You could try to make yourself invisible, but I will never allow myself not to see you. Unbelievable. And this is the end. Ladies and gentlemen, she says, the world stands out on either side, no wider than the heart is wide. You know how big the world is? Depends on your heart, on your leg. Above the world is stretched the sky, no higher than the soul is high. Want to know how high the Shamayim is? The heart can push the sea and land farther away on either hand. The soul can split the sky in two and let the face of God shine through. But east and west will pinch the heart that cannot keep him pushed apart. And he whose soul is flat, the sky, will cave in on him by and by.
I appreciate your indulgence, but that's basically what happens on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, we don't eat, we don't drink, we don't anoint ourselves in oil, we don't wear shoes, we don't engage in sexual activity. For all practical purposes, we're dead. We die on Yom Kippur. That's what we do. We die on Yom Kippur. Why do we die? We want to be like angels. We die because a person can feel life most profoundly when it's taken away from him. That's what Yom Kippur is. You have to die in order to come alive again. Now, the truth of the matter is that we shouldn't have to die in order to feel life, to appreciate life. We live in an incredibly abundant world. We have so much for which to be thankful for, and we fail to appreciate it. We have so much more than we need. Not only what we need, but most of us have so much more than we need. People have enough, some people have enough for 1,000 lifetimes, let alone for 1 lifetime. And yet there are people who don't have. And that's what Yom Kippur is all about. On Yom Kippur, we have to evaluate where we are. We have to look at what we have. We have to appreciate our friends, our family, our health, our life, the gifts that God gives us and endows us. The moda ani lefanecha melech chai v'kayom shechazarta v'nishmas. Asher yotzer es adam b'chochma. Uvaravo nikavim nikavim chalalim chalalim. We have to thank God for every aperture. We have to thank God for every tube that works in us, every passageway, every vein, every artery. Every time we go to the bathroom, when the plumbing works, we should sing hallelujah. That's what Yom Kippur is about. We take so much for granted that we should not take for granted. And the only time that we appreciate it is that when it's taken from us, and suddenly have a kidney stone, or God forbid something worse. And suddenly, because of a little microscopic dot of materials, you can't urinate. And you're in excruciating pain. God not only heals all flesh, but everything that we do, every breath that we take, every twinkle in our eye, every movement of our eyelid is mafli lasos. Is a miracle.
And only if your heart is wide, and only if your soul is wide, and only if your neshama is open to it, will we appreciate HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We dare not take it for granted, because it can be taken away so easily, so quickly. I'd like to close by reading another little poem. This is a Jewish poem.
It's based on the works of Rabbi Isaac Blazer, Kochav Or. And it's used to demonstrate the meaning of the phrase of Avinu Malkinu, our Father, our King. It's a song that was written, I believe, by a Talmud in Arsamayat Yeshiva. His name is Chaim Salinger, in 1993. And it's called The Arrogant Prince. I'm not going to sing it for you, but I'll read the lines. There once was a king, and the king had a son. The son was a clever but arrogant prince. And the prince would often act with open disdain and with bold disregard to his father, the king. And the king wanted hard to ignore it, but in vain was the burden he bore. So they banished the prince from the palace, though still what he wore were his royal robes. Well, the prince went in search of somewhere to begin, and he came to a town, but he felt out of place, for the men were all miners, they worked in the mines. And he, a nobleman, with his long royal robes and his soft royal face. And they made him an honorary miner, digging down in some forsaken hole. But the robes that were once much finer turned black as the coal and badly tattered. So then thought the prince, I am far too elite. I must dress and behave like the common folks do. So he let grow his hair, and he drank and he cursed, and he became like the others, though possibly worse. But the king had a change of heart one day, and he longed for his wandering son. But somehow they finally found him. But strangely enough, he'd forgotten who he was. So the prince no longer knew who he was. Well, there stood the prince in his black tattered robes, wailing out in the cold, saying, "Please, let me in." And the guard took one look at this strange ragged man and said, "I know the prince, and buddy, you're not him." But the king heard the noise in the palace and the pleading and the cries of someone, and he called to the guard, "Let him in! Let him in! Let him in! That's the voice of my son. That's the voice of my son. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King, please hear our voice. Please let us in. And though we are ragged, though we are wrong all along, we know it's true, Avinu Malkeinu. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King, please hear our voice. Please let us in. And though we are strangers, deep in our voice is the cry of your wandering son, Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King."
How do we prepare for Rosh Hashanah? How do we prepare for Yom Kippur? We are the wandering son, the prince, who had these dazzling clothes, and we've soiled them. But our Father, our King, recognizes us through everything, through every disguise, through every left that we send him unexpectedly. Yecheskel says, God doesn't want us to die. God doesn't, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to end in a terminal life, which could be, of course, living, but walking around as if we are a dead person. Kiyam b'shuvo, God wants us to return. God wants us to come back.
I want to just take one last moment and say to you that what the Kolel is doing here is chias, is giving life. What the Kolel is doing here is cleansing us from the dirt and the muck and the garbage that we collect, that we can't help but collect because of the environment. Our environment is so inimical. It is so difficult. It's so challenging to be honest, let alone to be good. It's so easy to fall into the wrong path and to make all sorts of misjudgments on what we're doing. Not everybody is evil, but we make misjudgments, and those misjudgments can lead us to causing a great deal of pain. But we have this opportunity here, through the Kolel, through learning, through sharpening our minds, to making distinctions between what is right and what may be right, what may be wrong, trying to be better than the average, better than the perch, lifnim mishur asadin, better to judge people favorably and to be beyond what they expect of us. You know, one of the most amazing ads I ever saw, I tried to find it, I couldn't find it. It was in the Jerusalem Post from the early 1990s. In the English version of the Jerusalem Post, there was a lost and found column. Listen to this, a lost and found column. And the ad said, found. Ramban, volume 2 of Nachmanides' English Chevelle's translation on Shmos. Found, reward offer. Okay, so the person found a Ramban on the bus, and he wanted so much, or she wanted so much, to return that item that they paid for an ad so that they'd have the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. Hashavas Aveda. That's what Mimishur as a did. Maybe it's the did. Maybe that's the way we're supposed to do. You know, Rabbi Krohn tells this incredible story of. This man who found, I don't know if you know what these things are, you know, an address book. We don't have address books anymore, you know. You have your blackberry and your blueberry and your greenberry. So he found an address book in a telephone booth on 47th Street in Manhattan. And he goes home and he starts calling the numbers, you know, to find out who owned the address book. And he calls one woman in Florida. And she says, it sounds like it's my daughter's address book. Some of the names, I recognize some of the names. So he says, can you call your daughter and tell her that I found it? So that she says, excuse me, mister, you know, why did you go through all this trouble to try to find, you know, who the owner of this lousy address book was? He says, well, I'm an Orthodox Jew. And there's a mitzvah Hashavas Aveda, and I wanted to return the lost article. So I'm doing this to try to find the owner. Well, he gets a call from the girl, and he arranges to meet the next day to give her the book. And he gives her the book, and she bursts out crying. He says, what are you crying? And she says, you not only returned my book to me, you returned my mother to me. My mother, when I became a Balas Tshuva 7 years ago, thought I was crazy. What kind of business is this? Orthodox. It's medieval, it's primitive. But when she heard that someone called to try to find out who owned this book and she saw that it was a mitzvah, she appreciated what I did. I've been reunited with my mother. These are the little acts. These are the little deeds. This is the way we can concretize those abstracts in our lives. We can change. We can change others. And believe me, there are so many others who are waiting to be helped. And it's my tribute to speak here to the Kolel Mitzion and the YU Kolel here in Skopje to see the incredible work that you've done here and continue to do. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu should bless you that you should have Hatzlacha Rabba so that there will be no more ignorant Jews in all of Chicago. No more ignorant Jews.
Don't have it.
We're losing Jews not because they're unhappy with Yiddishkeit. We're losing Jews because
They're illiterate. They're just illiterate. They may know that pork is forbidden, but they don't know beans about Judaism. And we have to give them the internal beauty and the substance of our Yiddishkeit. And the best way to do that is to provide a model for them in our own lives. Ksiva v'chasima tova, kiva v'chatima tova to those of you who speak Sfaradit, Ashkenazit, and thank you very much for
okay, thank you so much. An hour's late, we're going to take a very short, like 30 seconds drink break, and we're going to continue with Rabbi Greenland. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Work? Yeah.